So yeah, this begin with Gaza. I think it was extraordinarily predictable that the Gaza war would continue over Christmas, and indeed there's still talk in terms of Israel of the whole war continuing at some sort of level for at least another year. So far, according to Israeli so-called defense force sources, something like 9,000 Hamas fighters have been killed out of a total of 30,000. I've got no particular reasons myself to doubt such a figure, and nor have I got any particular reasons to doubt the figure being put out by Hamas in terms of its health authority in Gaza, which tells us at least to date 20,400 Palestinians have been killed. We're also told by the IDF that the north of Gaza, that will include Gaza City, has been quote unquote pacified. That reminds me rather of similar statements of from US generals in the Vietnam War who talked about pacifying a village. And of course, what they meant by it was its utter destruction. And that's what's been going on in the north of the Gaza Strip. And what we're told now is that a similar process of pacification will be applied to the center and the south of Gaza. And the results are, how should I put it, horrific and predictable. And that is, as you push people further and further south, you crowd them into a tighter and tighter piece of geography. What the Israeli Defense Forces will do is accuse Hamas, its armed wing, of hiding behind the civilian population, and will excuse its bombing, its missiling, its attacks, its sending in tanks against the civilian population because they're cruelly being used as a shield by the enemy. And the enemy are meant to be cowards, that they don't come out, they don't dare to come out and fight like men. That's the sort of narrative that we'll get from the Israeli armed forces. Exactly how things will pan out, I think, is absolutely impossible to say at the moment. I think it's worthwhile just looking at what's going on in Gaza at the moment and putting it into a regional context, because of course in Lebanon we've had the Israeli assassination of the Hamas number two, and in response to that we've had Hezbollah missiles launched at Israel, and Israel launching retaliatory air and I would guess missile strikes. But clearly, a war between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon is very much on the cards. We've also had in Iran, two bombs go off. The BBC reports that ISIS has claimed responsibility. Who the hell knows? Apparently, I'm told that there were not only, well, there were two bombs that it exploded, but there were plenty of other bombs apparently that were discovered. so that it wasn't just two bombs. But also, we've had American attacks on Iranian, or at least what is called pro-Iranian militias in Iraq. It's an extremely complex political situation in Iraq. I'm not exactly sure of the ins and outs of it, but what we have is a militia that's attached to the government. The government apparently says it wants the 2,500 American troops in Iraq to stay, but clearly this particular militia doesn't. But we've also had, in addition to Lebanon, Israeli attacks in Syria. And again, we have an incredibly complex situation of where initially, remember, in terms of the civil war in Syria, pro-Hamas forces, or maybe even Hamas forces, in terms of Palestinian refugee camps, for example, these people were anti Assad, and therefore brought them in conflict with Hezbollah. There's been a change there. So we have an incredibly kaleidoscopic, always changing situation. Meanwhile, of course, in the Red Sea, we have the so-called Houthi rebels. Why they are still called rebels by the BBC when they're in charge of the capital city is beyond me. Why isn't the so-called government called rebels? Either way, they've been taking pot shots, either with missiles, drones, but also with boats against shipping. We all know the stories of ships being diverted. We also know of the Americans trying to get together a coalition of the willing to deliver not only a blow against Houthi ships, but presumably land facilities as well. Worthwhile pointing out that Saudi Arabia won't be joining that coalition because it actually, having fought, in the civil war in Yemen against the Houthis, is now engaged in diplomacy and trying to come to some settlement with the Houthis. But also, we should add that what that means in terms of Egypt is an open question. I don't know what percentage of government revenue in Egypt comes from the Suez Canal, but quite clearly that is being affected as shipping is being diverted, around the Cape and all the way up the Atlantic. But more importantly, in terms of Egypt, of course, what we have is, as the population of Gaza, the 2.2 million population of Gaza, is packed and shoved further and further south, we clearly have a situation of where Israel, not openly, but although some ministers are perfectly frank about it, is getting ready for another, a second Nakba, a mass expulsion of the population over the border into Egypt. What that would result in, I haven't got a clue. I mean, will Egypt try to stop these people? If it tries to stop these people, will the government be stable enough to get away with that? I can't imagine it myself. We all know that in terms of the last free elections, elections where genuine opposition parties could stand, it was the Muslim Brotherhood that won. That what we have now is a continuation of the sort of army, security forces regime of Mubarak, but this time under Sisi. Will that regime prove stable under such circumstances? Won't the masses on the streets of Cairo and Alexandria be demanding that something must be done in terms of Israel carrying out yet another round of expulsion of its Palestinian population? Who knows? How stable is MBS in Saudi Arabia? What do the masses in Saudi Arabia think? What do the masses in Lebanon think, or Jordan think? All we know for certain is that such regimes are inherently unstable. They have no real mass base. They survive on the basis of being supported by the United States and oppression. And that really brings me to at least the possibility, not saying likelihood, but at least the possibility of the United States either intervening on the side of Israel, for example, if anything kicks off in the north of the country, or intervening basically to rein in Israel. And the United States could do that. If we look at the fighter aircraft that Israel is using, overwhelmingly they are American. They need a constant supply of spare parts. For every hour that such a plane as the F-35 flies, it will need something like 10, 11, or 12 hours maintenance work done on it. And of course, Israel also needs a constant supply of American munitions, for howitzers, for tanks, these 2,000-pound bombs that Israel has been dropping on Gaza. They are not made in Israel. They are made in the United States. And the United States can turn off that tap. And it would do so, and this is my take on it, not because it is particularly concerned with the suffering of the Palestinian people or the possibility of 2.2 million people potentially being displaced over the border into Egypt, but precisely it is concerned about the political instability in the entire region if such an outrage was allowed to happen at the hands of the United States's closest and most reliable ally in that region. So who knows? Who knows what will happen? It's worthwhile looking at Israeli plans. We've had the War Cabinet talk this way or that way. What we're told, one idea is to have a smaller Gaza Strip under the control of Palestinians, potentially the Gaza Strip under the control of the Israelis and then some sort of multinational force. Who the hell would want to be associated with such a colonial regime? I haven't got a clue. I can't imagine any other state in the Middle East, or for that matter, any other state in the world wanting to be associated with that. And indeed, what sort of local collaboration can Israel expect? I would say myself, none. And anyone who does collaborate with them in any such administration of Gaza, I would guess myself that they're very liable to being assassinated by the population that they're administering on behalf of Israel. So, at least from my angle, I would look at it, and in terms of this whole regional crisis, the potential of the whole region going down in flames. And so surely this is the sort of thing that Hamas was aiming for on October the 7th. After all, they've been planning this operation for a year. They are not stupid. They might not have expected their initial success to be so spectacular. They might have expected stiffer Israeli opposition. Nonetheless, they would have known that Israel would have responded, in a vicious, crazy manner. They must have calculated that. And from my angle, at least, they must have calculated that they couldn't have put up any sort of serious resistance to the Israeli Defense Force. But what they were relying on is either solidarity, but certainly the flame spreading to neighboring countries such as Lebanon, such as Jordan, such as Egypt. And again, I don't know enough about internal Saudi Arabian politics, but to the Arab Peninsula. And that seems to be at least a possibility. Okay. Let's also just deal with one story that is doing the rounds. And it's not an irrelevance, but I wouldn't call it, the key question in terms of what's going on at the present time. You can read it on various left-wing websites, you can read it on various green websites, and you can certainly read it on various Palestinian websites. And that's the idea, that the reason why Israel is responding in the way that it has, in terms of ethnic cleansing, that seems to be what's on the cards, is because of oil, because of gas. If we look at the Mediterranean, there are plenty of disputes throughout the Mediterranean about gas and oil deposits. And what we have in terms of the eastern Mediterranean is a field called the Levant. I don't know whether it's called a concession. It's by a whole number of different countries. It would be Egypt, it would be Israel, it would be Lebanon. I think Turkey is on the axe somewhere in there, maybe Cyprus. But also, one of the actors is the Palestinian Authority. And that was something that was agreed way back, in the Camp David Accords. This is before anyone had discovered proven reserves of gas and oil. And in collaboration with the Palestinian Authority, Israel gave a concession to some sort of British gas company. I think it was British Gas. I can't remember its full name. Was it British Gas Company, British Gas, whatever it was, in 1999. And they have reported successfully finding gas and oil reserves. Since then, there's been a whole series of different exploratory companies, a whole series of different companies that have establishing drilling in that part of the Mediterranean. And what we also have is Israel putting a stop to it, because one thing that we can be absolutely certain of course, is that they weren't going to let Hamas get their hands on any income. And as to the Palestinian Authority, they wouldn't have been particularly keen on that. But there are those that are saying the reason why Israel is determined on another Nakba in terms of post October the 7th is precisely to get their hands on this sort of lucrative oil and gas reserves. Okay, so I looked up what these oil and gas reserves are. And remember, that's a big difference between reserves and what you can commercially exploit. So, for example, the deeper the water, the deeper the drill has to go down, the higher the price. That's a crude way of putting it, but it's something along those lines. Either way, the figure of reserves in terms of the Gazan part of the Levant oil and gas concession amounts to 1.4 trillion feet. That's apparently how they measure gas reserves. I haven't got a clue how much that is. And so what I did, I looked up what I thought would be the biggest example of gas reserves in the world, and it was Russia, the world's largest country, one of the world's largest producers of gas and oil, and one of the world's largest exporters of gas and oil. Okay, and so what reserves do they have? Well, the figure that I had quoted, this is just on, normal, websites. So nothing, special or propagandy about it, was 1,686 trillion feet. So notice the 1,688. That compares with 1 trillion, just 1.4 trillion, that would go to the Gazan population, but it won't go to the Gazan population because the drilling rights are in the hands of the Palestinian Authority. So it's tiny. Of course, that would still make a difference to the population of Gaza, and perhaps it would make a difference, a real difference, to the population on the West Bank as well. Nonetheless, this isn't sort of world-shattering amounts of gas or oil reserves that we're talking about. It's pretty small fry. I don't know, what the price would be. I've already said, that depends on depth. It depends on the seas. But just to give an example, when I last looked up such matters, to get out a barrel of oil in Saudi Arabia, that costs something like $2. So I don't know what the price of oil now is, but if we said $50, $60, that gives you a rough idea of the sort of profit that can accrue from exploiting a Saudi oil field. The last figure I read for drilling in the Arctic, which they aren't, but there was talk about doing such a thing when, the price of oil was heading up to and beyond $100 a barrel. The price still in the Arctic was $180. That's why there ain't no oil drilling in the Arctic. So anyway, clearly that will be one motive in terms of Israel. But I think it would be completely wrong to explain what's going on in Gaza today on the basis of oil and gas. It reminds me too much of the left, that in the age of this myth of peak oil, everything became about oil and gas. So even the invasion of Afghanistan by the United States and its coalition was explained on the basis either of mineral resources or potential oil pipelines that had been proposed over the territory of Afghanistan. And certainly when it came to the invasion of Iraq, we had far too many people on the left explaining this invasion, not in the aftermath of 9/11, but explaining it on the basis of oil. I would call it reductive reasoning. I don't think myself that the Israeli cabinet and then the war cabinet When they saw what had happened on October the 7th, with over 1,000 Israelis killed, that they went and looked at the price of gas and said, "Oh, what we're going to do, we're going to seize Gaza." No, the response was political. And we need to understand the politics that are involved, both in terms of Hamas, but also in terms of Israel. Israel is a Zionist state. It's committed to a project of getting rid of Palestinians. Now, of course, they would have expected, we would have expected the prime target, the first target in that, to be on the West Bank. They're already under the Netanyahu government. There were plans to annex more territory. They'd already annexed the Golan Heights, they'd annexed East Jerusalem, and there were plans to annex whole blocks of the West Bank next to the Jordan River. And we've already had 400,000 FAKs on the ground, i.e., outside East Jerusalem. We've had 400,000 settler colonialists planted by successive Israeli governments. But in terms of this particular government, what we have is a much more aggressive approach to extending the official borders of Israel. And that clearly was on the agenda of the Israeli government. And clearly, well, at least in my view, at least, it seems that October the 7th took Israel completely by surprise. Yes, of course, they had a contingency plan available to them. They'd no doubt war planned it, but nonetheless, they were slow off the mark. But what they were responding to wasn't hunger for oil and gas, it was part of this plan for a greater Israel. And a greater Israel requires, if Israel itself is to be a democracy, it requires getting rid of the native population. And of course, Israel was planned by its founders well before Israel's formal declaration of independence, which I think was November, wasn't it? 1947, I think. But well before that, the Zionist movement was planning its future state of Israel to be a work colony. That meant clearing out the original indigenous inhabitants and replacing them with a new population. And the difference between Likud and the revisionist Zionists and the Labour Zionists was that the Labour Zionists sold this vision, with hypocrisy. With the idea that the Arabs would welcome the incoming Jews, and the revisionist wing of the Zionist movement just said, "Oh, let's not kid each other. Of course, the people are being colonized, let alone if they're being shunted off, their land are going to resist, and force will decide. We'll have more force. We'll be more effective militarily. We will win." And what they were calculating upon in terms of both wings of Zionism always was an imperial sponsor. Now, whether that imperial sponsor was the Ottoman Empire, the British Empire, France, or the United States, that didn't particularly matter, although it has to be said, having the world hegemon certainly helps. Okay, so my argument is this is about politics. This isn't about oil and gas. Not that that is an irrelevance. It's a side issue, an important side issue, no doubt, but it's not a determining factor. Meanwhile, when we look at the far right in the Israeli cabinet, what we get is just like with the revisionist Zionists, is how should we put it? Not necessarily honest. But more frightening declaration. So, for example, Finance Minister Smotrich from the religious Zionist party talks about voluntary migration by the Gazan population. And how the hell you're going to have voluntary migration, I don't know. But amongst the destinations that have been talked about, for example, are the Democratic Republic of Congo. Clearly, there ain't no voluntary involved. And we have Gevir, the National Security Minister. This is the guy that's given out guns to the settlers on the West Bank who are carrying out, of course, their own terror operation in the midst of what's going on in Gaza. He's from the Jewish Power Party. What he actually says is that mass expulsion is the only humanitarian solution. And there are people in Likud, Netanyahu's party, who are coming out, not Netanyahu himself, but in his party, who are coming out with similar statements. And we should remind ourselves that if we look at Hitler and the Nazi regime in Germany, that is the sort of program that they were committed to from 1933, really until World War II broke out and really got going. So their original plan, as we all know, was to let Jews go to Israel or anywhere they wanted to go as long as they didn't take their money with them. And we saw the Zionists, of course, famously campaigning to stop Jews going to Britain, stop Jews going to America, and insisting or trying to insist, they didn't entirely succeed, that they wanted people from Germany to exclusively go to Palestine. So they partially succeeded in sabotaging, but they didn't entirely succeed in that. Okay. Okay. So I just wanted to finish on that one, really, with this court case in The Hague that's coming up with South Africa charging Israel with genocide. I'm amazed so far that the death toll in Gaza has only been 22,400. I would expect any time soon, not from direct military action, but the effect of hunger, cold, lack of sanitation, lack of medicine, disease, to be the biggest, killer. That usually is what happens in war, both in terms of armies, but also civilian, population. So uprooting 1.8 million people, crowding them in the south without medical supplies, without adequate food, without adequate power. This is a genocidal act. And you don't just have to bomb people, you don't have to just shoot people. Look at what happened to the Armenians. Some of them, of course, were shot. But the vast majority died of hunger and disease. And so, to preside over the conditions that are likely to lead to such an outcome is a crime against international law. Excuse me. The United States has dismissed this South African move as baseless. I don't know enough about who sits and what rules they abide by in The Hague. Okay, so The Hague decides that Israel is guilty of either genocide or creating the conditions for genocide. What does Israel do under those circumstances? I think it puts the proverbial two fingers up and carries on. That's what the United States has done when it's been found guilty of breaking international law. Its basic reply is, well, we're big, we're strong, and who the hell are these judges in The Hague to tell us what to do? So when it comes to disputes over a few islands or fishing rights or whatever the hell it has happens to be, I'm sure various countries agree to abide by the court in The Hague, but this time, no. So I do think myself that accusations of potential genocide are far from hyperbole. I think this is real and it could happen. This isn't just something that that we have in the 20th century. It's something that could happen in the 21st century as well. Okay, I just wanted to move on, same sort of subject, a different angle. In terms of getting this political report together, I was looking, at various newspapers, and I came across, this is not from the physical copy, but the website of the Telegraph, and it ran with a story under this headline: Defense Secretary's daughter felt unsafe at university after anti-Semitic chants. Well, clearly this is Grant Shapps's daughter. The daughter turns out to be one called Tabitha, and she's at Leeds University. And I knew what the story would be even before I opened it up. I knew that this wasn't going to be a load of students going round shouting something equivalent to death to the Jews, kill the Yids, or something along those lines that you would have heard, on the streets of East End of London from the Mosleyites, or from the streets of German towns and cities with the Nazi party. Now, of course, it wasn't. And so, what it turns out to be, our poor little Tabitha has been upset because what these students in Leeds were doing was accusing Israel of being an apartheid state. And so, what we have clearly is a slippage of language, predictable, absolutely, totally predictable. The definition of anti-Semitism is shifting, shifting, shifting. And people can appeal to the dictionary if they want to. The problem with dictionaries is that dictionary writers follow common usage. And there's a shift, at least in terms of the establishment, in terms of the Zionists, from anti-Semitism being something that we all once might have shared. And that is prejudice or hatred or something like that against a Jewish person or Jews collectively because they are a Jewish person or because they are Jews, to something different. And so we have that slippage going on with the International Holocaust Memorial Association definition. And crucially, of course, it's was it 11 examples of what it calls anti-Semitism, half of which, roughly speaking, involve criticism of Israel. So, for example, you cannot call Israel a racist endeavor because that is racist itself. It's anti-Semitism. No, it's not. Zionism is a racist ideology. It begins with the assumption that Gentiles like me cannot live us alongside Jews. And what it also assumes is Jews have to have their own exclusivist state. That is a racist ideology. And of course, it's born of European politics of the late 19th century into the 20th century. And it doesn't just include the blood and soil racism of the Nazis, it includes all sorts of blood and soil racism that was on the rise in the late 19th century. It was this sort of petty bourgeois, reactionary bourgeois, response to the rise of the working class, the rise of the Marxist working class, but also the rise of a working class that often had, certainly in Eastern Europe, Jews in the vanguard of these parties. So, for example, the first working class party in the Russian Empire was the Jewish Bund, organized in Kingdom Poland. Okay. Anyway, of course, you know, I already knew it. Okay, Israel is an apartheid state. I just Googled it, looked up Wikipedia. I didn't need to go any further. It just told me a few dates and a few individuals. But of course, Amnesty International, as we've quoted in this current edition of the online, sorry about that, edition of the Weekly Worker this week in our statement from the Provisional Central Committee. Amnesty International defines Israel as an apartheid state. Human Rights Watch defines Israel as an apartheid state. Jimmy Carter, former president of the United States, when he wrote a book, you know, about the Israel-Palestine question, defined Israel in terms of where it occupied Palestinian territory. So on the West Bank, not Israel proper, and in Gaza. Our Jimmy said that Israel was conducting a regime that was analogous to South African apartheid. And the UN, of course, itself in reports 2007, that's what I needed to look up, 2014, 2017 and 22, their reports on Israel stroke Palestine have also concluded that the regimes in Israel and the occupied territories are, you know, they're parallel to what operated in South Africa. Of course, from a Marxist point of view, with the crucial difference that South Africa wasn't a work colony, it was an exploitation colony. It relied on native labor, and the colonists were going to be the supervisors of that native labor. So while there were wild talks of, you know, killing all the blacks and weapons that only kill black people, for example, fundamentally, the South African economy, you know, relied on native labor in a way that Israel doesn't. Of course, there are Palestinian workers. And of course, we know that before October the 7th, Palestinian workers crossed both from the West Bank and Gaza to work in Israel. But fundamentally, in terms of how we define a particular country, you can say that colonialism comes in a number of different types. You can include plantation colonies, for example, slave colonies. But yeah, fundamentally, what we're dealing with is a different political economy between Israel and South Africa. And that's precisely why we are quite right to talk about ethnic cleansing and the potential that that could lead to genocide, not only in terms of the Gazan population, but also on the West Bank. Israel has to get rid of the native population. Okay. Just wanted again to segue into a story about the Communist Party of Britain, the Morning Stars Party. Unless I'm wrong, my understanding is that the CPB has operated and maybe still operates a situation of where its members have available to it and are advised to go on anti-Semitism awareness courses, the sort of thing that was implemented in the Labour Party shamefully, you know, under Jeremy Corbyn, but of course with a lot less publicity because it's not real in the Labour Party today with Keir Starmer. Why the hell would an organisation like the CPB initiate any such thing? It's beyond me. I don't know enough about the CPB, but I know plenty about its origin party, the Communist Party of Great Britain, something I joined, at least I joined the youth wing when I was 13. I joined the Young Communist League. And of course, when I look back at my days in the Young Communist League and in the official CPGB, one thing that struck me was bloody hell. Our party is led by a combination of Scottish people and Jewish people. In my local branch, the branch secretary was a Jew. There were plenty of Jews. It wasn't in London, but the London organization was dominated by Jewish people. Obviously, as a result of the radicalization of Jewish people coming from Eastern Europe and the Russian Empire in the early years of the 20th century, vast numbers of these Jewish people were radicalized either before they came or in the conditions of Britain. So there were plenty of Jewish Bolshevik, Jewish Menshevik, Bundist, anarchist people that came to Britain, and plenty of people that went over to the left, in the conditions of East London or Manchester, but crucially, East London. I'll leave the Scots aside for the moment, but I would have thought myself. The idea of an inheritor organization, a fragment of the official CPGB needing anti-Semitism training is just an absurdity because I can assure you that while the fact that there were plenty of Jews in our party didn't go without comment, it was not a problem. It might have been on the very edges. We did have people that were soft on Zionism, but the vast majority, of course, of Jews in the official CPGB were quite the opposite. They were militantly anti-Zionist. And certainly 1967, the Six-Day War, sorted that one out. So what's been going on in the CPB? Well, what's been going on, I think, is that the CPB doesn't have an anti-Semitism problem, just like the Labour Party didn't have an anti-Semitism problem. What the CPB's got and what the Labour Party has and did have is a Zionist problem, right? And I don't know how deep it is, but Tony Greenstein wrote a useful article in the Weekly Worker a while back, and I can't remember the exact title, but I think it went something along the lines of the resident Zionist. And what he was referring to is an individual called Mary Davis and the writings and the influence of the writings of Mary Davis. And basically, to cut a short, you know, cut the story short, Mary Davis is a soft Zionist, and she thinks the left has got a problem precisely with Zionism that it shouldn't have. Well, I disagree with Mary Davis. And what's sad is that precisely her influence is malign. Not only do you get anti-Semitism awareness courses for CPB members, I was looking up some recent articles in the Morning Star, including two editorials. And what initially triggered my interest was an editorial by Ben Chacko back in November. You remember the so-called demonstration against anti-Semitism in London, which Tommy Robinson wanted to join but failed, but also did include that well-known anti-racist Boris Johnson. It reminded me of the Enough is Enough demonstration outside Parliament, called by the Zionists. Along with their allies, staunch anti-racists in the DUP, and what's his name? Former chair, Trebbit, is it Trebbit? Whatever his name, Tebbit, excuse me. Norman Tebbit. Why the hell couldn't I remember Norman Tebbit's name? Anyway, Tebbit spoke at that demonstration. Well, yeah. Exactly. And so what we had after this demonstration is Ben Chacko writing an editorial in the Morning Star, it was dated November the 26th, saying that the left has a problem with anti-Semitism. Well, sorry, Ben, I don't see it. I can find you a few comrades on the left. I call them comrades very much in inverted commas. I can find people, but they really are very few and far between. Certainly, when it comes to the organized left, they are more than a few and far between. I could think of a few individuals. I won't name them here, but we have dealt with them openly in the Weekly Worker. We've denounced them in the Weekly Worker, so we haven't been shy about fighting what is an entirely fringe problem. But yeah, Ben Chacko says that, look, there's been an alarming rise in anti-Semitism, which I admit almost certainly is true. But the problem is precisely that what we're dealing with is the redefinition of anti-Semitism, as I've already illustrated with the Tabitha story. Now, there will be assaults. There will be attacks. There will be examples of firebombing, I'm sure. Absolutely. But nonetheless, that is to be regretted. But it's also, at least in part, not to be excused, but it is to be explained in part, at least, of course, by what's not only what's going on in Gaza, but the claim that Zionism makes, the claim that the Zionist state makes to be acting on behalf of all Jews. And there will be those backward elements, some who will call themselves left wing or left wing ish-ish, some including Muslims who will say that, yeah, Jews and Israel go together. But what I've experienced, and I've been on all the big demonstrations in London. So I've been on the 100,000, the 300,000, the 800,000 demonstration. And I've not only marched, but I've tried to see the demonstration through from the front of the march to the very tail end of it on every occasion. And I can put hand on heart and to say, I saw no instance of what I would classify as genuine anti-Semitism at all on marches that Suella Braverman, remember, famously were calling hate marches. They were not hate marches. If they were hating, they were hating the Israeli state. They were hating what Israel is doing. But what was noticeable and encouraging and healthy under these circumstances is precisely the number of secular and religious Jews who are coming out in solidarity with the Palestinians, who are denouncing Zionism and the Israeli state. And their presence has been entirely healthy in precisely overcoming the backward attitudes that you would expect when a movement is welling up from the lowest depths of society. So precisely, there hasn't been a problem of anti-Semitism on the mass demonstrations. There isn't a problem on the left, on the organized left, with anti-Semitism. What there is in terms of the Labour Party, the Labour leadership, the Parliamentary Labour Party, and in the CPB, and in the Morning Star, is a softness, and I'll put it no stronger than that, on Zionism. And we have the same line repeated in the editorial in the Morning Star twice. That's November the 2nd and November the 26th. And this year, there's an article by one Solomon Hughes, who's some sort of soft, I don't know what, writes for the Red Pepper, writes for Tribune, writes for the Morning Star. And this comrade is saying that the left also has a problem with anti-Semitism. So, for example, if you take the comrades in the CPB GB, CPGBML, the Harpal Brah followers, that when they had a pamphlet, for example, that had the Star of David superimposed over the swastika, he actually says that this is to deny the Holocaust. I don't think it is to deny anything of the sort. What it's doing, I mean, it's not an image I would use. It's not a direct analogy I would make, but nonetheless, I've already made the case that there is the real potential, not only of, mass ethnic cleansing, another Nakba, but also the real potential of genocide being committed. And if we look already at the Gazan population, I mean, I might have said, well, only. And I'm not meaning that in any way of diminishing things. Only 22,400 people have died. If we take that as a percentage of the Gazan population, this is enormous. But what can happen precisely is you can put a naught at the end of that figure very easily with the spread of disease. Either way, what's happening precisely is not only the Daily Telegraph redefining language, we also have the police. Because, of course, the comrades in the CPGBML, we've had four arrests of those comrades for selling that literature, standing next to that literature, having that literature on their stall. We've also had similar problems experienced by the comrades in Socialist Appeal, who've gone with Intifada forever or some other until final victory or something like that. That's been found to be problematic by the Metropolitan Police. We've also had comrades in Socialist Alternative, one of the splits from SPIW, Socialist Party in England and Wales. We've had arrests of them. And we've also had the already mentioned Tony Greenstein, who's had his computer seized, had his phone, mobile phone seized for making statements that the police, I presume this time not the Metropolitan Police, but the Sussex Police, find problematic. Well, they find it problematic in the same way that our Tabitha up there in Leeds finds the shout, the accusation, the accurate description of Israel and the occupied territories as an apartheid regime. So definitions are shifting. Now, from our angle, we are not wanting to court martyrdom, but nonetheless, we're not going to be silenced, and we expect the rest of the left to take a similar position. But that could lead to arrests, that could lead to imprisonment, that could lead to the left operating in a semi or completely clandestine fashion. That's not something we welcome, it's not something we court, but it is something that we ought to prepare for. On the left. In other words, although Britain isn't directly involved, but it is indirectly involved, a nation that suppresses another cannot be free. Britain is complicit in this ethnic cleansing. Britain is complicit in this potential genocide. And in order to dampen down opposition to what's going on with the United States, his closest ally in the Middle East, we're seeing a ratchet of where anti-Semitism and what's legal and what's illegal is on the move. We've seen the effect of that in the Labour Party. We should expect more and more measures of that sort. And having Keir Starmer, of course, as Prime Minister, will make absolutely no difference at all in that respect. Okay, I've been speaking an hour and I'm going to wrap up very quickly. I'll just cover the rest of what I was going to talk about in the next few minutes. Very quickly, we've had Rishi Sunak, No election earlier in the year, we don't know, but that's what we'd expect. Just look at opinion polls, that tells you why. Last ones I looked at, Labour Party 45%, Tories 22%. He hopes that something will turn up. I was going to cover Reform UK, but I'm not going to do it now. I also was going to respond, and I'll do this very briefly, and that will be the last item to our resident Stalinist sad figure, Andrew Northall, in our letters page on the question of factionalism. According to our Andrew, factionalism is a bad thing. Why? Because if you have factionalism, your organization splits and you become impotent. Well, the problem is, Andrew, that the most effective left-wing organization in terms of human history, in terms of my argument, and I'm sure he would agree, was called the RSDLP brackets B, the Bolshevik faction of the Russian Social Democratic Labour Party. Yes, it declared itself a party in 1912, but it had factions. If you look at the description of the Bolsheviks' first legal conference after the February Revolution, there they are in Petrograd. There the comrades gathered. I think it was Kamenev in the chair, and he announces to the assembled delegates, "Right, comrades, get together in your factional groupings and present your speakers, who will put forward your distinctive platforms when it comes to our attitude to the provisional government." There was overwhelming unity amongst the Bolsheviks to oppose, this in spite of Trotsky's myths, to the contrary, to oppose the provisional government. There was never a serious issue on that, but there was a right-wing faction, I think consisting of six delegates, that did walk out. This is the conference that Lenin famously returned to read out his April thesis, which he had to read out twice. First of all, to the assembled Bolsheviks who wanted clarification. What does this mean? What does that mean? They were not shocked by the idea of carrying on the revolution. They were not shocked by the idea of Soviet government or anything like that. They'd been equipped with that idea since 1905, the summer of 1905. But Lenin also read out his document to the Menshevik delegates who were meeting in the same building. Yes, we had the Bolsheviks, the Communist Party of Russia, banning factions in 1921, quote unquote, as a temporary measure that became permanent. And it became internalized to great cost. At great cost to the left, excusable perhaps in Russia in 1921, after a civil war, after they've agreed to go into the NEP with all the dangers that involved. But that one aside, when I joined, Woody referred to this as a very young person. When I joined the Young Communist League, when I joined the official CPGB, what I learned from more or less day one is that this organization is rife with factions. And it was precisely the Leninist number one, that was published in November 1981, that revealed that truth. But everyone had known anyway that there were so-called tankers and so-called Euros. What the Leninist had the great virtue of doing is saying things are a lot more complex than that. There ain't just tankers and there ain't just Euros. There are many more factions besides. And how the hell, Andrew, do you think that CPB came into existence if it wasn't because of factions and factional alignments? And indeed, I've spoken, and I'm sure other comrades have spoken, to members of the Young Communist League, which seems to be in a bit of a lull. Has it collapsed? I don't know, but it seems since they got a new general secretary, I don't know what's going on with them, but they've certainly been very silent over the recent period. But I've been told by members of the Young Communist League that they are planning, they are plotting to replace the existing CPB General Secretary Robert Griffiths with a younger generation who've got different politics. And it's worthwhile noting, and I'll finish with this, at least when I last read Challenge, the paper of the Young Communist League, the editor there was saying that he, in particular, was inspired in terms of the past by a particular publication called Communist Liaison, which was a faction that came out of Straight Left, Fergus Nicholson, and a publication called Communist, which was circulated widely but underground by that faction. These were the communists that broke with Fergus Nicholson, who turned round after the collapse of the Soviet Union and said the project is historically hopeless for the foreseeable future. It was Andrew Murray, it was Nick Wright, and others that organized this thing called Communist Liaison that eventually went in and joined the CPB, was allowed to join the CPB. I don't know whether they still operate as a faction, but what I can assure you is there are still factions in the CPB. What happens in any organization, as you as an individual, you find fellow thinkers. And of course, what happens if you don't have legal factions is you have unofficial factions, but you have an overall situation where you have one dominant faction, it's called the leadership. And the danger is with one faction called the leadership is the membership is dumbed down. And if you wanted to see an example of that, we ought to put it up on our website, just publish the SWP's internal bulletins in the run-up to their conference, which is either taking place now as I speak, or is just about to happen, or has already happened. I'm not quite sure. I think it's now going on now. But if you look at the contributions from the rank and file, it's sad. These comrades have got nothing to say because they've been reduced to the level of speaking tools. This is the description that Aristotle gave of slaves. Of course, slaves were never just speaking tools, but the people in the slaveocracy imagined them, that all they do is carry out orders. And that's how Charlie Kimber, that's how Kallinikos, and the rest of them in the leadership of the SWP treat their rank and file. And that's how they've educated them. They've educated them to be speaking tools. And I'll finish with that.